Talk given Sunday, 24th October, 1971. Those of you who have been attending regularly may recall that the last two meetings we considered the question of non-possessiveness, where the body was concerned and where the mind was concerned. We looked into the unhappy aspects which enter our life through possessiveness, the positive evils which are born of possessiveness. And we also looked into the extraordinary illusion that all mankind suffers from, that we are the owners, perhaps the owners in perpetuity, of what we call in the ordinary way, my body, my mind. And you may remember I suggested last time that we might spend the fortnight, if you were so inclined and had the opportunity, in considering the significance of the word I. This word, as we all know, is the word that is constantly used by us right throughout our lives. What does this word mean precisely? What is its significance? We are all, if not most of us, if not all of us, are aware of the fact that our conception of the I is a misconception. We do not know what we call ourselves at all. And this misperception of our true being leads us into much sorrow and wrongdoing throughout our lives. The I conception, as ordinarily held by all of us, lies at the root of all selfness and all the evils that spring out of selfness. Nevertheless, that word has significance. What is its real significance? Because if we can understand this very clearly, we would set ourselves right, so to say, and orient ourselves correctly to the totality around us. If that is done, life no longer presents what are commonly called personal problems. The problems will be the same problems as before, and which we used to name personal. But you may remember some meetings ago, looking into this question, we saw that problems become personal problems because we ourselves are the personalizers. We make our problems personal instead of being able to see them and deal with them as problems. Life constantly throws up challenges. It is impossible to avoid that. As long as mankind lasts on the globe, environment will always throw up challenges. If I can see the challenge and understand the challenge as a characteristic of the situation here and now, a situation which involves me, the person, of course, but I do not get self-associated in the wrong way with that situation and that challenge. If I can avoid all that, then the problem is not a personal problem. The moment I personalize it, I introduce all sorts of limiting factors, all sorts of spoiling factors. I have a vested interest in the outcome of my dealings with the problem. And if I have a vested interest in the outcome of my dealings with the problem, I am always going to sow the seeds of further problems and further conflicts. As I said, life will always be full of problems, but I must approach the situation free of the limitations of separate, isolative selfhood, self-consciousness. Now the religious life, the holy life, call it what you will, is very much concerned, is most intimately concerned with freeing us from that selfness, so that we fulfill our particular place in the scheme of things, whatever that fulfillment may be. If I approach the scheme of things personalistically, I will always distort the scheme of things in my imagination. I do not know what the scheme of things is. I do not know what the shape of the future is. And I must recognize that fact. And to try to peep into it with my present incapacities is nothing short of folly. Therefore, I must let life bring forth what life means to bring forth, instead of interfering with the process of life and obstructing it with my limitations and my follies. This is important. Now, where does the I significance come in? The fact remains that each individual human being is an individual human being. And it is impossible to speak, to communicate with one another, unless we use those personal pronouns, you and I. This is perfectly obvious. But when we misconceive this I as an entity, as something which is going to acquire, gain, attain, achieve this, that or the other for itself, then one is in wrong relationship with the totality. The self is there, but selfness is what poisons the life of the self. The individual who is born comes to fruition to full egohood, to full maturity. Egohood is there, but egoism spoils the beauty, the harmony, and the health of ego, the self, the person. So, how do we help ourselves to understand the full significance of I? Consider our self-conception. Is it not fundamentally rooted in, associated with, and limited to the living body? This, for example, is the way a little child thinks of itself, introduces itself, presents itself. I am John, I am Mary. And by that I, And by that name is meant just that particular living body. Isn't that the case? Look back into your own past, your childhood days. I simply meant this body, this living body. And as we grew older, we associated the mind with it, our mental processes. And all that was thrown up into consciousness as the result of the activity of these mental processes, my desires, my ambitions, my abilities, my skills, my defects, my qualities, all these got associated into this complex called the I. But it was regarded as a separate, specific entity, which was my property. And this is surely erroneous. If we look deeply enough into it, this body, which seems perfectly stable, and it is, reasonably so, within our lifetime, is constantly receiving elements, material, from outside, and it's constantly giving out material. What about the material that comes in? When I breathe in, when I eat, is that part of me or not part of me? And what when I breathe out? Is that air which I breathe out no longer me? Have I therefore become more by taking in momentarily and disbecome by breathing out? And what happens to that air which I breathe out and which you breathe out? In this room, for instance, we are all breathing it in and out, aren't we? It's all got mixed up. Now, is that or is that not part of each one of us? In which case, what precisely is meant by I, by you? If one looks sufficiently deeply and inclusively, one will see that to limit the word I to a particular pattern which is visible, which can be heard, which can be touched, is a mistake. For all practical purposes, of course, it is convenient so to regard it. And as a matter of fact, one's appearance is something which remains reasonably constant through life, so that we recognize the person and don't mix him up with somebody else. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that our ordinary conception of you or I is limited, completely limited, to that which is visible or audible or touchable and so forth. And if one goes beyond just the intellectual perception of this, and really sees the thing in its wholeness, becomes intensely aware of the actual fact, we will find that the word I is true only of the totality itself. It cannot be applied to the different parts composing that totality with that same completeness and absoluteness and precision with which it can be applied to the totality. But if this is the case, what is its great, its supreme implication? That each one of us who calls himself or herself I, quite naturally, because this is the way language is made, is completely and entirely interrelated with all particulars composing the totality. You know how, for example, in the Brahmanical teachings in the Upanishads, they present the concept of Brahman as being the absolute all, the objective presentation of Brahman as the absolute all. They also use the word Atma, which is the subjective term to represent precisely that same absolute all, the totality. Now, what is the difference between the two? The one is an objective term, the other is a subjective term. Let me put it this way. If Brahman, the absolute all, were to utter the word I, then Atma is the meaning of that word I. Or if you like it the other way around, the meaning of Atma is the word I. But only the totality can say I, with absolute significance. And where you have an absolute significance, no division is possible. No analysis is possible. No separation is possible. What is possible and what is the actual fact is total and complete interrelationship. Now, we as we are not so much ignorant of that fact in the intellectual sense, but we are unawake to it in the inner depths of our consciousness. This is where the difficulty comes. It is the inner depths of consciousness which have to undergo this awakening process. Now, you may ask, well, how do I do it? You can't. How can the finite become the infinite? You see, this is where so many great ones, geniuses, certainly most intellectuals, stumble. They think in terms of the person becoming the all, or in some mysterious way going through some technical process, some discipline, by which the individual discriminative consciousness becomes this absolute total awareness, cosmic consciousness as they call it. This is merely super-egoism. And of course it's quite impossible. We all know the lovely fable where the mother frog inquired how big was the beast who came and trampled upon one or two of the young ones. This big, this big, this big, and finally the frog burst. Well, that's what happens to us. In our inner consciousness, if we try to become this big, this big, this big, then the mind gives way under the strain. That is why, unhappily, some who try to tread the path of religion, religion in the grand sense, in the deep sense, are not quite all there afterwards. No, it is not a question of I, the limited person, becoming the all or the absolute. It is a question of my so understanding the situation clearly that I cease to obstruct the totality from functioning freely through me. Now, this is the really important point we have to get hold of. There is no such thing as the person, the individual person, attaining, achieving, gaining, grasping, etc. But there is this tremendous reality. The individual person can cease to grasp or attempt to grasp this, that, and the other. He can, in fact, let himself be denuded, completely denuded of all that he calls himself or his own, And in that process of denudation, everything which we hold and value, we must let go. We must let go, not positively attempt to cast out. So many have made the mistake of positively attempting to cast out beliefs, ideas, anything, everything, physical possessions, wife, child, and all the rest of it. But this is to shirk one's responsibility in the world for the right use of whatsoever there is in our particular environment. This is not true asceticism. This is not true renunciation or relinquishment. This is escapism. It is foolishness. What we have to be free of is the sense of possessiveness with regard to anything. The sense of mine-ness, of I-ness in relation to anything. When I and mine, in their ordinary everyday connotations, have completely ceased to influence our thought and feeling and our daily actions, then we are free within ourselves, whatsoever the external circumstance may be. It is a complete transformation of our understanding of the relationship of this living organism that goes by our own name to the totality. Complete transformation. And then all burdens naturally fall off. That is the true asceticism. When one really sees for oneself, this is not mine, this am I not. When one really sees that, then there is no longer any grasping. And every burden in the mind falls off. And you see, freedom is within the mind of man, not in external circumstance. This is something we never really get hold of. We think we do. We have grasped it intellectually, perhaps, up to a point. But it is merely a superficial understanding. Because the moment the circumstance is such that one's possessions, one's status, one's business, one's family are concerned, we immediately act like the animal which grasps, the mother animal which grasps its young. That's how we act. Let us have no illusion about it. Is there a single pleasure in which we indulge, which we really let go? Do we? Let go. If it comes our way, all right, enjoy it. But are we free from the hankering, from the lusting for that pleasure? However wonderful and beautiful it may be to hear Klemperer conduct the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, if you like. Marvelous performance. And of course we rationalize it all to ourselves. Ah, this is education, this is a case of the growth of our aesthetic nature and all the rest of it. Perfectly true, it is. But am I grasping after the greatness, the beauty, the marvel of my conceptions? Is it that or is it not? Because if I am hankering after it and grasping it, I am bound to it. And if I am bound to it, and if anything comes in the way of my indulging it, I will be in conflict with the person or the situation or the event which comes in the way between me and the gratification of my pleasure. And the most exalted example of that, of course, is the service of God. Notice how the servants of God, the devotees of truth, those who will lay down their lives for the supreme that there is throughout the universe, will not fail to hurt their neighbor if he happens to come and detract them from what their own desire in the name of the service of God, etc., is impelling them to do. But is this religion? Is this the religious life? Because the context of religion is the transcendent itself, is the absolute totality, is that upon which I can lay no limitations and to which I cannot dictate any conditions. It, the absolute, deals unto me all the time. It is the omnipotent, the omniscient, the omnipresent. I come into being out of infinity because of it. And when this little I has finished, it's back in that infinity. And infinity is neither more nor less because I was born and because I died. If one really sees that, then the religious life can emerge freely, naturally, sweetly, on its own. It, the totality, the absolute, all, call it God, Godhead, call it Brahman, call it whatever you like. That is the thing which comes to manifestation through you, through me. You or I can obstruct it because I am unawake, because I am ignorant, because I am possessive, because selfness hinders me all along the line. I can obstruct it. But what happens as a result of my obstructing? I suffer and I introduce pain and suffering into life for others. There is no getting away from this. This is a fact of our existence here. Now you see the tremendous difficulty involved in being non-possessive, non-grasping. We say, but these beliefs which I hold, I have proved through my own experience to be truth, irrefutable truth. To whom have I proved it? To myself, maybe. To others, some others maybe, but not to all others, and certainly not to the absolute, to the reality. There is nothing which I can prove to the reality. I am like a little puppy yapping at its master when I am like that. To let go everything right within oneself, not to grasp it, is the most difficult thing in the world. But it is the state of bliss when you have let go. It is not only the state of bliss, it is the unresisting state, it is the state of complete and perfect resilience and purity in your own self, which enables the totality to come to fruition through you. And this is the meaning of religious living. That the mysterious, unknown, the unknowable, the transcendent, the absolute, comes to fruition through you. And the charm of the whole thing is that when it comes to fruition through oneself, I, the little self, do not know it. Change places with a rose, with a narcissus or a hyacinth, pouring its perfume onto the air, absolutely unknowing who enjoys it or who doesn't enjoy it. This is the nature of our real fulfillment. To remain blissfully unconscious of perfection, of divinity, here now embodied in ourselves. And we remain blissfully unconscious of it in the state which is really the supremely awakened, enlightened state. See, religion and the religious life is of this nature. Contrast this with what the world ordinarily calls the religious life. To worship God, to accept such and such beliefs, doctrines, dogmas, because they represent what they call the unalterable eternal truth, and so forth. That's what they call the religious life. And to live, you know, the good life according to the rules laid down in the blue book. Well, we've played about with this sort of thing for at least 6,000 years. And look at us. What are we like? Where are we? Still seeking for reality, for truth, lighting our little candle in order to see the sun, consider this very quietly, calmly, not discursively with the intellect, arguing, producing pros and cons and so forth. That will lead us nowhere whatsoever. But in the quiet, in the state of peace, when the mind and the heart and the body are completely still and silent, then in that stillness you awake to the real rhythm of life itself, a mystery which we know nothing about. Then we know the zest of living. And in that silence, which is infinitely eloquent, we hear the wordless voice of truth. Truth in the religious sense is not a descriptive thing. It is a silent thing. It is the being awake without being too discriminatively conscious, but being awake, being aware intensely of that which is here and now and is going through its living process. That is truth in the religious context. People believe, for instance, that if they go through this discipline and that discipline, which is called a religious discipline, and they see visions and hear sounds and whatnot, we have lots of descriptions of all this from even some of the so-called great mystics and so forth. Therefore, they are living religiously and progressing towards a supreme state where they will be personally in touch with God. This is all nonsense, utter nonsense. I can never be personally in touch with God. You know how it is said in the Old Testament, no man can see God and live. And yet they say, of Moses, for instance, there are two or three other instances too, saw God face to face and was with God 40 days and nights. And yet Moses was alive. That is how it is written in words. What do you think actually happened? When Moses, who said I, meaning Moses, the son of his father and mother, earthly father and mother, was completely unselfed in his innermost consciousness. There was no separate I, a solid block obstructing the free entry and living of the Absolute, Yahweh. Nothing to obstruct it. And one can be in that state for many days and nights. This is a fact. It is true that it is a fact which has been realized in human history by a relatively few, very few. Nevertheless, it is a fact. And then talking about that fact after the event, they talk about it in the mistaken terminology of everyday conversation. I saw God face to face, or something like that. Now that's hopelessly wrong. It is the totality that takes you into itself, because you are unresisting, completely resilient, completely pure. Therefore, it can shine through you. These fundamental things, it's very important to understand. Because if we don't understand these, then our what we call our efforts to live the religious life are invariably and inevitably misdirected. Because we set our sights wrongly. If one is making the journey to the moon, let the direction at the starting point be ever so slightly wrong, and you will go right away from the moon, won't you? Or let your mode of re-entry into the earth be ever so slightly out, and either you'll get completely frizzled to a frazzle, because you'll get burnt up, your whole spaceship will be burnt up altogether with the immense heat generated, or you will bounce away from the atmosphere into space and wander through the long grey glooms of time until you're dead. And that is all. So one has to set one's sights right. Now I have given a physical analogy, which of course in quality holds good. In terms of actual representation, hopelessly misrepresents. Because you can't set your sights where the infinite is concerned. It is everywhere. You haven't got to set your sights in a particular directional sense. But you set your sights in terms of the inner consciousness, the inner awareness, which emerges regarding your own self and regarding the totality to which you are completely with which you are completely interrelated. When that is there and there is no grasping at anything, you let the totality work through you, then there is fulfillment, there is fruition of a nature and of a pattern which one must not predetermine or preconceive, which one doesn't know. Isn't it true that the happiness and the joy which comes to us unpremeditated, just suddenly comes like that, is the supreme thing? For instance, take the wonderful day we have had today, this lovely, brilliant sunshine and so forth. Supposing I had the capacity, the ability to engineer the weather conditions and produce this wonderful day, would it have meant the same ecstasy, the same bliss to me, as it has indeed meant today, simply because it has come absolutely out of the blue, literally out of the blue? And you see, one's true fulfillment comes that way only. Because the source of this fulfillment is not that which is limited, me, the personal separate self. It is the unlimited totality. It is the abounding riches which ever remain absolutely unmeasured and unmeasurable. And it is a case of being aware, not of possessing, not of going through an experience. We think in terms of, having an experience of sublime wonder and delight and all the rest of it. No. Whatever is an experience, a vision, a particular bit of knowledge or something, all that is perishable. The finite comes into being out of the infinite, has its little day, and back into the infinite it sinks. But if one is in touch with the infinite itself and makes no attempt to grasp at the finite, then you live in the everlasting. If one understands that, one ceases to approach religion in order to solve one's problems, in order to find peace, happiness, truth, consolation and healing for one's frustrations and sorrows in the worldly struggle for which we have been defeated. There is neither success nor failure where truth, where the reality is concerned. Neither are petty little joys or sorrows, are pleasures or pains. Nothing of that is there. And it is in awakening to that sort of thing that at last I become man in the true sense of the term. Until then, I am only sub-man. I am not true man. Now, one may say, oh, what a lot of words. Yes, what a lot of words. I might have tried to convey this in complete silence. But would you have understood if I had been silent? Or if you try to convey something to me in silence, would I understand what you are trying to convey to me? Sometimes we do understand. Two people meet. They are perfectly silent. They may just happen to sit at the same table in a restaurant or side by side in a train going somewhere. And some communication takes place in the silence. Now, isn't this a fact in our lives? And if it happens like that in little instances, like sitting at the same table at a restaurant or in the same compartment in a train, can it not happen in the supreme depths, in that profundity which is the absolute all, embodied in our particular limited selves? This is the marvel and the mystery of our existence. It can happen, can't it? But how does it happen? Only if I am unresisting, alert, mindful, pure. Then this magic takes place. And if the magic, the real magic takes place, this magic is not an illusion, like magic in the ordinary way for the amusement of people is an illusion only. This magic is a true magic, which is truth itself, which is being itself beyond all description, beyond all definition, beyond all limited, particular, finite perception. One must not want it. One must not desire it. One must make no attempt to grasp it as such. That is to say, it. I am using the word it in the sense of this which may be intellectually perceived. Let it happen. You see why and how our efforts almost always end in dust and ashes. We rebel against something which we see and declare to be wrong and evil, and we must get rid of this. This terrible poverty, this terrible shadow of fear under which we live, this and that evil as we see it in our daily lives, personally and in terms of the life of nations and internationally. We see all that. Now what do we do? What we see is the external shape of things. We are conscious that it is wrong, that it is evil, and if it is not wrong or evil in itself, sometimes it isn't, the fact remains that that situation hurts us in some way or other. It hurts us, which means that we don't like the shape of things as they are. What do then? We predetermine another shape, which we say, this is the desirable shape. For whom? For me, my friends, and those who think like me. But there'll be millions of others who don't think like me, remember. You see? So, If I feel sufficiently strongly about it, with violence I shall overthrow the old and try to bring in the new, and then make believe to myself and try to make believe towards everyone around me. Now the millennium has set in. Comrades, we have brought in the new world order. And how long does it take before the next lot of comrades rise up, throw us out, shatter our order, and introduce their petty little new order and millennium? And it is always done with violence. It is always done with hurt. But the law of the Spirit is not relative. It is not reciprocal. It is absolute. Thou shalt do no hurt. It's the law of the Spirit. Thou shalt do no hurt to anyone else or to your own self. Now this requires extraordinary intelligence and extraordinary skill. And you know where the skill and intelligence lie? Not in any positive action, but in completely refraining from all wrongdoing. This is the positive way in the religious life. The refraining from the ill. You see, we think that we have to establish truth and love and beauty and goodness and all that. Not at all. Truth and love and beauty and goodness and all that are absolutely constitutive of the universe itself. It is we who have injected untruth and ugliness and all the rest of it into this. The moment we abstain from it and refrain from it, there the truth is, in all its wonder and marvel. Those of you who have attended regularly will get really tired of hearing me say this over and over again, ad nauseam. You can't put cleanness into a room, but you can get rid of the dirt in the room, and the room is clean. Isn't it? That's how it is with us. We are divinity embodied. But there is a little demon inside us. And he interferes and blocks everything up. All we've got to do is to see that, yes, I am the demon. And when I have really seen that I am the demon, that demon turns very, very shy. And he stops bossing me. Then that demon in me, the devil in me, becomes my obedient servant. Because that demon is my technique, my skill, my capacity. It is not God who does the work of creating and building the universe, but his dual servants, the angels and the demons, the constructive forces and the destructive forces. And they don't meet in conflict, really. They meet in complementary activity. That's what makes the universe go round. It's like it exerts a force like what the mathematicians call a couple. You see, it's a couple. And therefore the thing begins to turn round and round and the whole thing evolves. But we humans have this power of looking within ourselves, becoming self-conscious, and opposing our self-conscious little selves against the totality. Because I like this, I'm going to try this out. Don't we all do it? In the family life, doesn't a little infant, as soon as it begins to feel itself a little bit and self-conscious, see how it starts getting cheeky towards the parent and opposing the parent? But this is the way of life. So you see, this demon in me, I have to see and understand. Once I really see him and understand him, he becomes my obedient servant and no longer obstructs that which is transcendent, but skillfully brings into being the forms through which transcendence manifests itself. This is the great thing. Now, this business of sorrow in our lives, you know, the bulk of our sorrow is unnecessary sorrow. As I said earlier, don't approach religion with the desire to get rid of your sorrow by being religious. That way it will never happen. It will never happen that way. But understand what is actually happening inside the mind and the heart. We all know this word, mind. We all know the word psyche. We know the word, but we don't know the fact, the reality, which these two words represent. Now here is just a suggestion. Let us approach the understanding of what we call mind, what we call psyche, in this way. Every living organism, you and I, have a receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the organism. This organism can receive impressions and stimuli, and it can respond to those impressions and stimuli. All right? This receptive, responsive sensitivity is the personal aspect of mind. Mind, the totality, the universal something, just as the scientist says, the absolute ultimate energy out of which the whole physical universe comes into being. That mind is power. Power of a nature which we know nothing about. It is not measurable. It has no forms. It has no dimensions at all. To us, it is a mystery. But it does function. Don't ask me to prove it. It's quite impossible to prove this thing. If you yourself can enter into those deep states of consciousness, you will experience the working of it. And that's how one can know it. That is all. This immeasurable, dimensionless, formless, universal, total power operates through every individual organism by virtue of this receptive, responsive sensitivity in him, and the two together, this sensitivity in us and the universal power without, is that which functions in us as our psychical life. But the psychical life, which is specifically our own, so to say, as long as this organism is alive, the psyche has its roots in the soil of the body itself. If there is no living body, there is no psyche. And by the same token, there is no receptive, responsive sensitivity, because it is the living organism which is receptive and responsive to stimuli. You see? But the universal totality, mind itself, remains unaltered, of course. The operation of this which is transcendent power or energy, with this here within oneself, which is measurable, formed, possessed of dimensions, limitations, expressions, and so forth, within oneself. The two together constitute our whole psychophysical life. Now the psyche has something very strange about it. The laws, if I may use that word, it is a poor word, but no other word comes up to my mind at the moment. The laws of the spirit operate in the psyche absolutely. And the psyche can never say nay to those laws. And they are absolute laws. Translated into human words, things like this: thou shalt do no hurt anywhere. Thou shalt not grasp at things. They are not yours. They belong to the totality, to the absolute. In our ordinary, everyday human life, we are told, thou shalt not steal. Take what is not one's own. And so forth, you see. Thou shalt not self-indulge. If thou dost not self-indulge, then the bliss of the Absolute will always permeate you and flow freely through you. See? These are the laws of the Spirit. And these laws of the Spirit, operating through mind, the universal, the unknown, affect the living psychophysical organism here now on earth, you and I. From the other side of the situation are the laws of behavior of the art of living as individual human beings, which we call our moralities, our ordinary moralities. All our ordinary moralities have their transcendent aspect also, the absolute aspect. They have their relative aspect too. Now, whenever I think, feel, speak, do anything whatsoever, its impress goes right into the psyche. Into the psyche. And that which is purely mental in me, the pure mind, I mean pure not in the sense of clean, but in the sense of mind and nothing else but mind, as free of the psychophysicality of my being, that which is mind knows both ways. That is to say, knows in terms of transcendence and knows in terms of ordinary everyday experiencing here and now, in the limited finite sense. And this knowing is permanently within the psyche, which the brain doesn't know. Sometimes the brain knows. Then we are consciously aware of this, that, or the other. And this conscious awareness is the coming, our awakening to what we call conscience. We say somebody is conscienceless. Nobody is conscienceless. The conscience can be suppressed, but it is there. This pure mentality in us and the psyche in itself are already know. So whatsoever I think, feel, say, do makes its impress as so much energy which has to be worked out in the psyche itself. And whatsoever is wrong brings pain, perplexity, sorrow to me myself as well as the environment. Whatsoever is right brings, releases faculty, perception, intelligence, power to act and live rightly in the world of affairs, both with respect to myself and to what is around me. But deeply embedded in the psyche are all these forces. These forces embedded in the psyche is one of the deep, profound meanings of the word karma. That is your karma, which works out, which in its working out through the psychophysical life releases the pattern of your particular life in the world. Now, the brain and all the mental activities, which are the conditioned activities of the conditioned brain, can play tricks with us all along the line. We try to rationalize, to explain away this, that, and the other, which the psyche knows is either right or wrong as such. And this is where we suffer at our own hands. There is no mysterious divine power or demonic power which judges and decrees punishment or reward to us. It is right inside here. We are constituted that way. The laws of our life and how we should live and so forth are all embodied in our own living being. And it is the living process of our own living being which liberates those forces into external manifestation. If you can grasp this, if you can understand it, I mean, really try and work upon this. Understand it. And you will, and the ways of release will open up before you. The ways of release, both ways. The dissolution of so much unnecessary sorrow and evil things in our own nature, they will be out of the way. On the one hand, and on the other hand, as they are out of the way, the paths open up for fulfillment. Fulfillment not as I or you preconceive what our fulfillment ought to be, but that which lies in the womb of eternity itself. Then you will never say no to whatsoever comes to you in life. You will never reject it. Nor will you accept it desirously, because then you attach yourself to it, you grasp at it. But whatsoever comes to you, you will understand it, you will be in right relationship with it, and you will make the right response to it. In this is your human fulfillment as man.